I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The neon sign is back in the news with an announcement from the Krispy Kreme donut people that they've agreed not to display their distinctive neon sign at a new donut shop in Boca Raton, Florida. That's right, no bright red Krispy Kreme to tell people the donuts are ready. Well, it turns out they didn't have a choice. The good people of Boca Raton feel so strongly about what they consider the garish, down-market glow of neon that they have banned all exterior neon signs. Just one more chapter in the story of the slow disappearance of neon. You know, ever since Lady Bird Johnson talked of America's roadways as endless corridors of junk and neon back in the mid-1960s, the neon sign has been losing its luster. Well, there are some moves afoot to rescue neon, to save the old signs that once split the night and led us through the dark to the clam shack or the liquor store. Think about it now. Think about the neon that you know. It may come up in your imagination as a beer ad or the silhouette of a cocktail glass or even a naked woman. Connection listeners, what killed neon? Was it that it was becoming the illumination of sin? Or is there another part of America that neon lights up particularly for you? And if that neon sign goes dark, does a part of American history, a time, a place, or a mood go dark with it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio today is Dave Waller. He's a collector of neon signs. You can see, in fact, part of his collection right now. It's at an exhibit called New England Neon at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Nevada Public Radio in Las Vegas is Sandra Harris. She is the executive director of the not-yet-open-to-the-public Neon Museum there. But in fact, some of those monstrous signs from her collection are on view at the Nevada State Museum and Historical Society, and that's an exhibit called Neon Unplugged Signs from the Boneyard. Hi, Sandra.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. Now, Connection listeners, much more information, images of these signs, and stuff about the various exhibits at our website. Go there if you want to take a look at some of the unique pieces that we'll be talking about on the program today. We're at theconnection.org. Dave, I want to start with you because you actually began looking for these things when you were quite a small boy. And I was wondering whether or not it was just like you were looking for something to collect, or was it something about neon that drew you to these signs?
I think neon dragged me into itself back when I was a kid. I was driving around on my bike with my brother Mike, and we went to the dump. We used to go to the dump a lot, just looking for stuff, and we found a little metal sign. Matter of fact, I brought it in right here.
Hold it up so people can see.
Yeah, it's a little metal sign, and it just says Top Coats. And you can see where I folded it in half with my bike.
Because it wouldn't fit on the rack otherwise.
Fit on the rack.
And, it looks about the size of a street sign, but wait a second here. It's just a piece of metal with the words Top Coats painted on it. It doesn't have any neon, or it doesn't have any... So
I had to graduate up to neon.
Okay,
I had to start
so this
slow.
Was step one.
Yeah. And after a while, I started collecting more and more signs. They were free. Kids really weren't into collecting them. They weren't like baseball cards. They didn't have any value. And I started getting into neon signs because they just seemed much cooler than the signs that didn't light up. And after a while, I bought a truck that could haul signs. And then I, in a junkyard, found a crane that could put on the back of the truck. And then I had to buy a big firehouse to put it all in, and now
you have how many neon signs now?
About 60, I think.
Now, this doesn't include the little Miller.
No, not the
signs. They don't count.
No, not for me. There's people that collect them, and they're great and everything. But I've tried to concentrate on the big, one of a kind. Almost the bigger, the better. Although I'm sure Sandra, when you get out to Vegas, they get really big. I don't know if I can handle any of those.
You lose the scale, Sandra, when they're hanging up on the side of a building. You've got a lot of them down in what you call the boneyard. How big
Correct.
Are some of these signs?
Some of them are 20 to 25 feet tall. The one we're getting this week, actually, from Treasure Island is 36 feet tall. And so you're right. Until you're next to them, I think that's part of what people really enjoy when they go through is you understand the scale a lot differently.
What does the Treasure Island one look like?
It is a large skull. Anybody who's traveled lately and seen that hotel, it's a giant skull with cross swords, and it looks like a pirate theme. And they're retheming the hotel to get away from that pirate theme. So down comes the sign.
Now, I need you both to help me, though, with the neon itself, because we're not talking about just signs. We're talking about neon signs. We're talking about something that distinguishes those signs from everything else that tells us, you know, where we should shop and where we should eat and where we should gamble. So help me out, the two of you. I don't know what it is about neon, but you've spent a lot more time looking at it than I have.
I think it cuts through the glare better than any other type of sign. It has a light at night that really can go for miles through fog and through rain and through the dark. That's very, I think it draws people into it.
And because of an intensity or?
I think it's something to do with the wavelength of the light and the way it pierces the night. A lot of science going on in that tube, and there's something about it that really goes a lot further than an incandescent bulb.
I think also if you look at the history of the signage itself, the design that utilizes the neon, there's usually some very unique quality to that sign. Even if it's just letters, it's the way the font is, it's the colors that are used, that it's more eye-catching than any other way of using signage.
Now, let's do a little bit of history here, because we have to go back to about the 1920s for the first neon sign in America. Is that right? Sandra, can you help me with this?
Right. It's about that time. And the first one in America actually was a little bit later than that. And it was for a car dealership in Los Angeles, late 30s.
But
when
did those monster neon signs start going up in Vegas? Is that also a turning point?
In the 40s. Absolutely. That's a turning point. And it coincides historically with a lot of things happening in Las Vegas, the gambling and the signage went right along with it. But during the 40s is when you really started to see those elements that we think of when we think of vintage signs.
And Dave, the era that you're plucking signs from, is it the 40s, the 50s?
I think it is. I think that was the big heyday for neon. By the 60s, plexiglass had started creeping in as a favorite medium for signs. And then by the 70s, it had pretty much tapered off to about, I think, where it is now, which is the sign industry is certainly not dead, not by any means, but it's nowhere near where the glory days were. I mean, it was almost like an arms race with different businesses promoting themselves and just making bigger and flashier signs. It was pretty unregulated at the time, and so things got out of hand, which is just the way I like it.
And interestingly, it's still that way here in Las Vegas.
You're totally unregulated there.
Well,
and we're talking about signs too, aren't we?
It's still sort of an arms race. I like that. I like that analogy, because one hotel will reinvent and create this amazing sign, and the next hotel will do the same. And it all boils down to who can do it in a bigger, more amazing way and draw people in. And so it is still a competition, a friendly competition, but a competition nonetheless.
No, I grew up, as probably most of us did, sitting in the back seat of a car and looking out the side window at these things going by. And so what always sticks in my mind are the motel signs, the vacancy, no vacancy, right? Mm-hmm. It's something to do as you watch. And I get it made me wonder how much of the neon that we know is tied into this country as a car country, as a driving country.
I say almost all of it.
Yeah?
I agree. I agree. I think almost all of it. It as we start to study it historically, it developed with getting people in off the roadside, and it started with the small motel courts where you drive in and have a small garage. But the signage was there, and it continued to grow as we grew into more of a resort era, and now the giant mega hotels. It still revolves very much around that industry.
I have a bunch of signs that have arrows in them, and it's almost worth just doing a study on that, because there's the sign itself says, you know, Billy's Motel or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's always just this big arrow that starts at the top, goes to the bottom, and then bang, bang,
this
flashes.
This flashes in sequence, right? This way.
Yeah.
Well, the one that is hanging outside the new exhibit at the National Heritage Museum, that's the Flying Yankee restaurant.
Yeah, that's a great one.
I mean, this is one that I saw the picture, Flying Yankee restaurant, funny name for a restaurant. But then you dig into it and you realize that it's way more a part of the town and the time.
Yeah, that has a rocket ship attached to the top of it, and the flames animate through the sign in a real neat 50s shape. And I'd had it for years before a sign historian friend of mine, Arthur Krim, who's pretty much the expert on neon signs, he said, you know where that's from? I said, yeah, I took it down. It's from Auburn, Mass. He said, well, that's where Robert Goddard fired his first liquid-fueled rocket. And I thought, oh, that's why there's a rocket on it. Never even knew. So the signs have little stories built into them. Each sign seems to say something. And if you dig back, you can find out a lot about them.
And Sandra, in your case, it's the atomic motif that keeps popping up in the days when the signs were first being made in Vegas?
It sort of turned the corner when that happened. We have two large collections of Stardust letters from the Hotel Stardust, and they took that atomic theme, and it was a theme for the tourists in general. You were theming your hotel around it. You were theming, you had the atomic bar, atomic drinks.
This is when nuclear weapons were a good thing, right?
Right. When the testing was going on, it was this novelty that actually tourists were talking about, and it was interesting, and it was capitalized on. We had Miss Atomic Bomb in Las Vegas. And there's signage to go along with all of that. And I think what you just said is exactly why a museum fits this signage. You can look at every sign and come up with what was happening during that time, what was going on, and interpret those stories through it. It's amazing.
There's a picture in Rudy Stern's book, Let There Be Neon, of looking down the Vegas Strip. You see Vic, the big cowboy there. And in the background is a mushroom cloud from a nuclear bomb test.
Right. It's a
which
very
is done
well-known
up in
sign.
Neon.
No, it's a real nuclear bomb test that you can see in the background.
Right. And that picture was used in tourist publications.
Come to Vegas.
It was at that time, it was a fascination with that going on. And the social context of that is amazing for us to look at now. But the signage reflected it and followed those themes right through it.
So is it that we can now look at neon as a folk art representation of a particular time in America? Is that a way of looking at it?
That's one way we look at it, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that you can almost tell the date of a sign by the design of it.
Mm-hmm, you can.
The angles in the 40s were all sort of streamlined, and the edges were curved, and they used to have little speed pieces of neon that would go around.
Is that
around
where we get the mobile gas horse, this kind of streaky red horse? Is that a 40s symbol, for example?
I think that came along in the 40s.
Yeah. I'm just trying to sort of pluck neon pictures out of my head as I'm...
And then in the 50s, everything got more angular, more sharp corners. They did a lot more animation in the 50s. I think in the 50s it really went crazy because of drive-in theaters and lots of roadside. I mean, everybody had a car, so everybody was out on the road, so... You got to just bring them in. I have a bowling sign from, Orlando, Florida, that's a pin that's about 18 feet tall and a ball that's about 12 feet in diameter and a neon explosion that goes between them. It says Colonial Lanes. Mm-hmm. And I hauled that all the way back on the back of a truck from Florida and almost killed myself and a lot of other motorists as well.
All right, Connection listeners, this hour a chance to talk about neon, the neon sights and signs in your own past. And when we come back after the break, a chance to talk also a little bit about the way that they're made, because one feature of the disappearance of neon has a lot to do with the difficulty and the danger of actually putting this stuff together. So we'll play a little bit in the science when we come back and take some of your calls, your notions of neon and what those signs tell us about the United States. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and if you are taking your part of this summer when you've got some time on your hands to listen to our conversation about neon, you could also go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. Take a look at some of the neon signs that have been retired and been resuscitated by people like the guest who I have in the program today, Sandra Harris, Executive Director of the Neon Museum of Las Vegas. Don't try and buy a ticket to the building yet because the building hasn't been built, but it's coming, right, Sandra?
Absolutely. Yes, it is.
Dave Waller's with me in the studio. He's a collector of neon signs, and 23 of his signs from his collection are now on display at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts, and that exhibit is open. Now, I said that we were going to talk a little bit about the science because I'm not sure that I quite get it, so I want you to both take me through this. I know that neon works because there's a gas inside glass, right?
Yeah.
That part I've got. Does each letter in a sign, is each one its own contained little thing, or can it weave all through the sign so you get this great long tube spelling something out?
Sure. In a small sign, you could have an entire word that's spelled out with just one tube. I think the limitations might be the length of the tube and the diameter. At some point, it becomes too impractical to run an electrical charge through it. But you could get a tube that could be 10 or 15 feet long pretty easily that would have that would light up.
And Sandra, these all had to be hand-done at the time when neon started?
Actually, they're still hand-done, and I think that's what a lot of people might not know about the art form.
I didn't know they were still being done.
They're still hand-done. It's a combination, if you think of glass blowers, and you take that sort of activity and then throw in the science that we're discussing, each neon tube is still bent. They're called neon benders. And so these individuals train as artisans, and it is very much an art form done each piece by a person, and a lot of people don't realize that.
And there's more than just neon inside some of these glass tubes, Dave.
Yeah, there's the noble gases, which are the ones
the
on the right
gases.
Of
I
the
like
periodic
that.
Table. I think there's helium, neon, krypton, xenon, argon.
Argon.
Those will all light up quite nicely in a tube, some better than others.
Why would you choose one over another?
Oh, they light up different colors. Neon gives you that bright, bright orangey red color. And argon, which is the other common one, mixed with a little mercury, gives you a nice big bright blue. And from those two gases, you pretty much can make most of the colors. There's people that can do xenon, but it runs really hot, and there's a lot of limitations. But those are the two favorite gases. And they're inert because they don't break down chemically and turn into something else. So they can stay inside of a well-made tube for 40 or 50 years. And never burn out. There's no filament inside. It's just the gas that, when you pass a high voltage through it, loses an electron and then regains an electron, and in that process it gives off light, just the same as lightning.
And the other piece to that is each tube can be lined with a coating, which then changes the way those gases go through, and that's how you get over 100 different colors, is the combination of those gases, the charge, and then whether or not the tube is coated and how much.
See, I always had this layman's notion that all neon was like a fluorescent tube, and they just painted different paint on the outside of the tube, so that's why it glowed red or that's why it glowed blue, but it's all the gases inside, and so what we look at is a clear tube?
You would if a clear tube, if it had neon in it, would be orange. If it had argon in it, it would be blue.
Right.
And then any other colors.
But when it's unplugged, though, it's...
Oh, they're clear. Yeah, you can see right through it. It's pretty neat.
Cool. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Ipswich, Massachusetts. Rick's joining us now. Hi, Rick.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine.
I like your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what are you... are you a fan of the neon sign? What's your involvement here?
Oh, goodness. I gave it a try back in the 80s, I think. Took some classes in glass blowing and tried to make it a neon artist / sign maker. And it's really something that people either get or they don't.
Did you get it?
I got it.
Yeah.
A lot of other people didn't. Boston, I think, is where style comes to die. This is just, at least then, it wasn't the environment. My background is actually in plasma physics, and I've always been a light junkie and a glass junkie anyway. So it seemed like a natural combination, and it was an awful lot of fun, but you're up against commercial sign shops and unions if you're trying to be an independent. And if you're trying to do it as neon art, you've got to be in some place where people appreciate it, which is, again, it wasn't around here.
Did you ever make a sign that someone put up in front of their business to bring people in
sure.
to help their
yeah,
close
I, I've done movie theaters and stuff like that, and actually was on Evening Magazine about a million years ago when they did a piece on neon. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun, but it's really tough business to get into. If you've got some other means of supporting yourself while you're in, for example, making normal signs or something like that, but it's a really tough thing to get into. I'm back doing physics again because it's a lot more straightforward, and it's just it either works or it doesn't. In the end, you can really work your heart out on something, and people say, it really isn't quite what I want. And you can't redo it easily. You have to start over from scratch. So.
Rick, you're a better man than I, because I took a class. My wife gave it to me for my birthday for bending glass. And I made up just a big pile of molten glass, and that was it. So if you managed to make a neon sign light up, my hat's off to you.
Well, actually, I took 3 semesters of scientific glassblowing at MIT evenings, and that was my original interest in glassblowing. And then once I got into plasma stuff, it's a knack because neon and plasma physics are pretty much the same thing.
Let me ask you a question, though, Rick. I mean, if I were to come to you and say I want a sign and I don't really care how much it costs, and so should it be neon or should it be one of those plastic backlit things, and you had to make the case for neon, what would you say to me? How would you talk me into putting up that neon sign?
Well, first I'd try to talk you out of it, I think. if you were still interested, then it's a process of education. Again, it depends on the application. I've made things for people who, once they saw what it was, I guess I really was thinking about plastic or something like that. And it's really tough for people to visualize what they're asking for. As consumers, unless they really neon.
I mean, Dave, one of the things that I find about these signs is that however cool they look at night when they're all lit up, in the daytime they look a little trashy.
Yeah.
You know, outside the laundry or outside the pancake house, you've got these little twisty bits of glass all over the outside, and it kind of interferes with the sign in a way.
Yeah, they paint the background to look pretty decent during the day, but you're right. They have all that clutter of the tubing and the housings and everything that take the face of the sign and make it look kind of nasty. But at night, you know, that's when the magic comes out. I think also neon signs, people might think they look old-fashioned or kitschy or something nowadays. That's why you maybe don't see as many as you used to.
But I think an interesting point is that's the attraction now for a lot of signs that are being designed, at least here in Las Vegas, is that throwback to an era when those designs were prominent, and you're seeing sort of a resurgence in those retro kind of signs.
But nobody sees
happening
the,
here.
Nobody sees the Vegas signs in daytime. Everybody's sleeping in Vegas in the daytime.
Exactly.
So you only ever get to see them at night. But what about the idea, and this would be something that the two of you can help me with, because the New England neon excursions that you go on, Dave, are kind of a long way away from Vegas. But did neon do itself in by becoming too associated with sin, with selling liquor and cocktails and that sort of thing?
It might have. It became a really great medium for bars because people are out at night, strip clubs, and I have a neon signs from a couple of strip clubs that the museum had to decline because of the family nature of the museum. But that's okay. There's plenty of other signs to look at there. And I think that that people just associate it with sort of trash and, I don't know, bad living. So it might have done itself in.
Sandra?
Of course I don't see it that way. Our collection...
Because you live in Vegas. You don't want to admit to living...
I live in Las Vegas. I'm happy to admit that I live in Las Vegas. And I think the majority of our collection in the museum, if you look at it sociologically, is not related to this subjective term sin. We have a lot from laundries, cleaners, family businesses. It was day-to-day life, which is what we talk about. And when you talk about a business that's selling alcohol, what we're doing from an anthropological and educational perspective is people worked in these places. There are human beings with lives and stories, and people would go and drive by, and even if you aren't buying liquor, you remember the sign, and the design elements of that sign are worth talking about.
Yeah, so, that's a big thing, Sandra. The whole idea about each sign representing what the business was all about and what the neighborhood was all about. I know sometimes when I've taken down a sign, I find out later that people almost get lost because you always took a left at that giant bicycle.
Exactly.
and now it's the landmark's no longer there.
That's exactly why this museum was founded. People who saw their landmarks going away, people who lived here and have lived here for years and years, who saw their landmarks going away and wanted them preserved, just as any other city may have something else in a collection that they want to keep, and they elicit those memories and those ties to a community.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Rick, thanks a lot. Nice to have a neon bender on the program. Next to Cambridge now, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Just only yesterday I was talking with a gardening friend about using neon in the garden. I think that...
That's a cool idea.
I think that neon, in a way, it's gotten a bad rap from its success and its association with, as you say, you know, kitsch and roadside motels, which are all very beautiful.
Yeah.
But neon, aside from associations, the glow of the tube and the hum is so beautiful. It's akin to the vacuum tube glow on an old television set. It goes back to, you know, thermionic tubes in the beginning of the century. It's a very wonderful, magical thing. And I think that creative use of neon would just could blow away, you know, all of the baggage that it brings with it, in this country anyway, from roadside uses. Let me see here.
It's like neon, we never knew you. Now,
I think that's actually true, and I'm sure some of your listeners could list the contemporary artists who use neon in remarkable ways. I'm thinking of Ian Hamilton Findlay off there in Scotland, but others too who use it, really focusing on the glass, no metal background reflector, just the glass glowing in the dark.
How would you use it in the garden?
The specific discussion was a courtyard in a school in Cambridge that needs some enlivening. But even in my own garden, elephant ears, gigantic turnips or something. And if the concern is that they would look bad in the daytime, well, pulley them up. I mean, just hoist them up into the sky, higher side of our building, and get them out of view and away from vandals, and then just like lower them down again later for the evening, put on a little neon show. But the comment really is that neon is such a beautiful material and has these wonderful kind of pure almost a pure associations with I'm going back to vacuum tubes
You're taking this a little bit beyond nostalgia. It's not just I like the signs.
I want to blow away the nostalgia part of it, really. I think that, neon wasn't treated well by nostalgia. It's been used too much for that.
Well, John, you can have both. There's a guy in L.A. who has a 20-foot-tall dragon from a Chinese restaurant in his garden in the backyard.
I like that idea.
I think that's a great point, too. There's another museum in Los Angeles dedicated just to neon art, the Museum of Neon Art, and that's another application of neon, and I agree with you, there are many ways to look at it. It's not just signage.
They haven't stolen anything from Vegas, the MoNA Museum in Vegas, or in Los Angeles?
No, we have a great relationship. If it's a sign, it comes our way. If it's a neon artist or somebody that wants to work in neon, it goes their way.
I've tried, Dick, believe me. I've tried to get neon out of Vegas, and they're not parting with a tube.
It's not going
to
happen.
Is it harder now to go to a motel and say, I just love this neon sign, would you give it to me, or can I buy it from you?
I've never done that. I've always waited for them to come to me, or their time to come, or the place to go out of business or something. I like to drive around and see them just as much as anybody else. So,
but you like them where they are.
I'd rather have them where they are, but if they're coming down, I don't mind being there with a truck.
Right, and we actually have the proactive approach as a museum. We have what's called the Living Museum Project, where we are approaching businesses that have spectacular examples of signage and asking them to promise if they are going to take it down or if it's going to be remodeled or changed that we would get first right to the sign.
1-800-423-8255. John, thanks for your call. Next to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and John. Again, hi, John.
Good. Good morning. Thanks for having me on here. First off, a little FYI, the Mobile Pegasus logo began in the mid-1930s, and there's still a neon Pegasus sign in Indianapolis. But
thank you for that.
I think it was out of Gas Station Memories, a book that had that in. But my favorite, I remember this even, that's probably one of the first symbols I remember, was the Holiday Inn signs, the big, bright, illuminating Holiday Inn signs. You could see those things for 2 miles off. The yellow, the purple, the orange. It was just one of those beautiful signs, and they all kind of went down the wayside in the early 80s. But I really think that what happened with that, as well as a lot of the other neons, is not as much a part of how businesses want to be looked at as much as the fact that it's just gotten so expensive to maintain business, and everything has been geared toward bottom line. to a point that they look for every little way to cut and become more cost-effective, and if they can just use some regular fluorescent lights and a plexiglass sign versus, say, a big bright neon that has to cost a lot more to operate.
Is that true, Sandra, that the neon itself is high-maintenance stuff or higher maintenance?
It's not really higher maintenance. As far as the day-to-day maintenance, I guess it would also depend on what part of the country you're in. I mean, we obviously have a huge network of businesses that's what they do. But the tubing is very durable and will last for quite some time. You do have tubes that'll go out once in a while, but it's really no different than a light bulb going out if you're in the business.
Yeah, that Holiday Inn sign, John, that you mentioned, that was called the Great Sign, and the one that replaced it's called the New Sign. So that ought to tell you what everybody thinks.
I was interested in looking at the that I recognized the Simple Simon and the Pyman logo in the pictures of the neon signs, but I'd never registered that with Howard Johnson's as being their particular one. Now, in the case where Howard Johnson's became a chain, did they have the same neon sign available to anyone who wanted to set up a Hojo's in the early years?
Oh, yeah. They made hundreds of those signs. And in about I think it was around the 50s, they really started making those big porcelain enamel-faced stainless steel and neon extravagant signs. They were wonderful signs. I think those and the Holiday Inn signs are the two kings of the roadway for chains that made fantastic big, great signs.
Have you got any in your collection?
Yeah, I got a couple.
Why did I know the answer to that question? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, your connection to neon and whether or not you moan the fact that you don't see as much of it beside the road as you used to, or is beautification about getting rid of those glowing red bars? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 for your contribution to our conversation about neon, whether or not we've had just about enough of it and we should be happy to see the signs coming down, or whether or not something's lost, some part of the nation's history disappears every time one of those signs comes down. Dave Waller, who's a collector of neon signs, is in the studio here with me. Sandra Harris, who's executive director of the Neon Museum of Las Vegas, is joining us from the Nevada Public Radio studios in Las Vegas. And Dave, I want to start with you, because the part about the neon signs that I really can't imagine or can't cast my mind back to are where you'd have something like, you know, McIntyre's clam stand, which is a wooden box, just a stand at the side of the road, and almost everything's invested in this huge neon sign above it, like it's worth more than the building itself.
I love that. I that sign too. It's funny. There's a cowboy who's lassoing a chicken, and the feathers animate. They blink on and off like he's struggling to get away. And it says "Chicken in a Hurry, Western Style." And that sign was meant for another business, but before the business went up, the business went out of business, and so the sign shop just went around and tried to find somebody to sell it to. So they sold it to a clam stand, and they decided to put chicken on the menu because they had the sign. And they had it up there for 50 or more years, and finally they took it down to put up a new roof, and I just found it on the back of one of their picnic tables. They were just tired of it. They were happy to see it go.
Happy to let you take it away. Go ahead, Sandra.
I think that point is a well-taken one. If you look at the development of the hotel industry in Vegas, that at the beginning, many of the hotels were nondescript buildings, and absolutely the money was invested in a sign. And even today, where the buildings have become signage themselves, architecturally speaking, a huge portion of that budget will still go to the signage. And that, historically speaking, is absolutely true, that's where you want the money, because that's what people are looking at, and that's what will draw them in off the road.
And we can look back at that time and say it's true that people went to this casino instead of that casino because this casino had a bigger sign or a flashier presentation?
something about it, whether it was the theme or something that it was advertising, it would draw them in. And that they still bank on that to this day.
Let's go to Ashby, Massachusetts now. Phil's on the line. Hi there.
Hi there. How you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. This show is making me really sad. I'm a big fan of Neon. And in contrast to the other caller, I'd like to speak up for nostalgia. From my childhood is when I first fell in love with these things. And speaking of nondescript boxes, there was a fashion in western Pennsylvania where I grew up right after World War II in the proliferation of bar rooms that happened, I guess, when the troops came home. There was an architectural fashion of making the most minimal generic bar room you possibly could. And they were all just these squat cinder block buildings. Just these little gray cuboids that would virtually disappear. You wouldn't even see them in the daytime. And if they had any signage at all in the daytime, it would be some hand-lettered sign that said Girl Chick's Tavern or something like that. But
the art was getting people in the evening?
No. The sole adornment these buildings had was several alternating bands of pink and green neon right around three sides of the building, just under the roof, and maybe a single flashing sign that just said tavern or maybe just beer. And these buildings became absolutely distinctive at night. And it's really a case of form following function, and just neon reduced to its absolute essential use, which is to identify the building at night.
So would the neon bender, Dave, then have gone to that building and said, okay, you got, 20 feet across the front and 15 feet across the back. I'll put the neon right on the building?
Oh, yeah. They'd probably say I could wrap it around once for $2,000, twice for $4,000,
twice for $4,000,
and so on and so on. And depending on how much money you had. But I think it makes a little building like that, like those taverns, look a lot bigger than they really are.
Yeah.
And the point of bringing out that distinction of a building, I have to respond to the Boca Raton point that you brought up this morning.
Oh, yeah,
okay. I find it fascinating because I sit on a committee here for the National Scenic Byway Program, if you're familiar with that. And our scenic byway is a portion of Las Vegas Boulevard, and we are now constructing the design standards that require an element of neon for each of the buildings to be considered part of our National Scenic Byway. We're the only scenic byway in the country that will be a nighttime scenic byway. And it's just as relevant as any other type of adornment or style that would fit that national byway program. And I was fascinated by that point that other communities are saying, absolutely, our design standards say, take it away. And here we're preserving it.
And you're saying, you've got to have it.
You have to have it to be considered, yes.
Dick, on my block right where I live, there is a little sign ordinance by the do-gooders downtown that thought that they'd take all the signage off the block. It was a commercial block, and replace it with exactly the same sign. So now it says cleaners, barbershop, et cetera, et cetera. And you just can't even find your way anymore. I mean, it's so bland, and I don't know what people are thinking when they want to standardize everything to the point where it's all the same. But individual businesses really need an individual look so that you can find them and so that their identity is out there on the street. And it's just such a mistake to...
Well, even a piece of it, if you think about it, the businesses that are the same. We have McDonald's everywhere. What do you think of? The Golden Arches. What is that? That's their sign. Even when you have many businesses that are the same, that symbol, that visual symbol that's different and distinct is what makes you remember it. And that's what stands out in a person's mind.
1-800-423-8255. Excuse me. Phil, thanks for your call to Greensboro, North Carolina now. And John's with us. Hi, John.
Hello, hello.
Thanks for calling.
Just thought I would give you an interesting anecdote to my first experience with neon signs. I used my garage at one time for my weightlifting and treadmilling and my drinking of my beer. So I got the idea to put a neon sign in there that said John's Bar and Bale. Well, that worked good until the first time I turned it on, and the neighbors thought my garage was on fire. Called the fire department. I'm in there on the treadmill, and the firemen come bursting through the doors with their hose. I guess they were going to put out the neon sign. But anyway, that was my first experience there with it, and it is now hanging in Pinehurst, North Carolina. And when it is on, the neighbors know they're welcome. And when it is off, they know that the cooler is closed.
Now, did you have this? Did you have this made for you, John, or did you make it yourself?
No, I had it made. There was a little place in Sanford, North Carolina, that probably had 15 employees. They're out of business now, but I went in there one day and was watching them make those things. That's a very interesting art. It really is.
Now, I have a question for you. If were the neighbors on your street a little bit suspicious about some guy with a neon sign outside his garage? I know that a number of neighborhoods where I've lived, people would go, no, we don't want that neon sign on our street.
No, this was inside my garage. They saw the glow coming through the window.
Gotcha, okay.
That's why they thought the garage was on fire. Had firemen coming in the garage door and the back door of the garage. So,
well, it proves neon works then, huh?
There you go. It does. It attracts attention. So, yeah. Enjoy your show.
All right. Thanks for your call, John. Nice to have you with us. 1-800-423-8255 to Sharon, Massachusetts now. And Dave's joining us. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Really interesting topic, very rare topic. I'm a former collector of neon, and I just wanted to make a comment about...
What's a former collector mean? You sell it all, or what?
You know, I live in a house where it's just impossible to display, unlike Dave.
Okay, so he's got it all now, does he?
I used to have a Philco radio sign that I got out of a furniture store. The sign was actually never used. I bought it in the crate. And I tried to display it several times, but it got to the point where it just didn't really fit in anymore. But anyway, the reason why I'm calling is just to kind of get my two cents in about why I collected neon. And one of the things I found most attractive was for the old stores that had, you know, that had no longer were in existence or no longer used their neon, the appeal was that, it was a really poignant sign that when these companies put up their neon sign, there was a presumption that these stores would be around for a while, that it was a really personal investment and statement in themselves. A lot of times it was small businesses. And nowadays when you see all these sort of injection molded plastic things that are backlit by fluorescent lights, they're done on the cheap and they all look the same, you know, this, I think in a way that's sort of like a symbol of the fact that there really isn't that kind of presumption of permanence anymore. Everything's very disposable. And I think also that there's a more rational business decision now about, you know, people are rational when they say it doesn't make economic sense to do it. But it wasn't a rational decision. It was an extremely emotional, personal decision back then, you know, in the 30s and 40s when most of these were done.
It's a great idea. I hadn't really thought of that, you know, if you were setting up a restaurant in the 40s, it was your business and it had your name on it, you know?
That's an awesome point, Dave.
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't know what to say. I felt that all along and never was able to put it into words. But you're right. There's just such a so many of the signs from back in the day were, you know, Dave's Donuts or Bob's Car Wash or something like that.
And it might not have been pretty, and it might not have been, you know, really artfully stitched together, but it was a real personal statement.
And I think the other connection to that, which we're finding in a lot of our research, is even the sign designer that would be part of that. You'd have that individual business owner, but the sign designers, that's a whole other hour of topic. But these people are so passionate about taking those ideas and transforming them into this art form that they become attached to it. We now have children of sign designers and so forth coming through the museum and talking about watching the process. And it is a very emotionally tied process.
Yeah. So Dave, are we done with neon? Is that another time?
We're done with big scale neon. I have in my office. I have a piece of neon that I got from the office of a motel, and it's done in a very ornate script. And again, it looks very personal and very inviting to look at. But I think in terms of scale, the days of huge you know, displays are probably pretty much over, unless of course I decide to. You know, renovate of some large building and live in it on Sunday, but that's probably not going to happen.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you in the program. Sandra, I wanted to ask you about one thing that I have to tell you. I was looking through my notes last night about the signs that you have collected that have been taken down, that have outlived their sort of current usefulness. One of them was the Hacienda Horse and Rider, which I guess was recently put back up on Las Vegas Boulevard.
It was actually the first sign that was restored by the museum, and it actually went up in 96. And it was taken from one end of the strip where the hacienda was, which for people that have visited lately, it's where the Mandalay Bay stands. And it's now installed in downtown Las Vegas near Fremont Street, where the first neon would have been.
But what cracked me up about it was that I looked at when it was originally installed. It was originally installed in 1967. You know?
Right.
I mean, things don't last very long in Las Vegas.
We move at a quick pace, but the point, I think, out of all of that is that we move quickly as a museum. It's a different kind of a museum business to save these things and to recreate. We have 12 signs that we've restored that are downtown in Las Vegas.
And do they stand out against those buildings that are their own signs? Does the neon stand out?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They do.
Yeah, visually, there's nothing that compares to it, and your eye just automatically draws in.
They're
a lot of people debate that.
They're set up like sculpture. In odd little angles and so forth as you're walking, so you can really contemplate them apart from the huge signs that are still down there.
Right, we look at it that way. They're installed really as public art. We see them as an outdoor exhibition, and when you are closer to them at that scale, you can explore all those angles. As Dave was saying, they're beautiful.
Which is actually kind of one of the neat things about seeing them in a museum setting is that you do get a whole lot closer to them than you normally would. You're not driving by them, and you're not looking way up, David, you know, some kind of motel sign, but you get to see it up close.
Yeah, they're a lot bigger than they seem when you get up close.
All right, you guys, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us on the program today. Dave Waller, nice to have you here.
Thanks, Dick. That was fun.
Dave Waller is a vintage neon sign collector. Some of his signs now on view at New England Neon Exhibit at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts. Sandra Harris, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate this.
Sandra is executive director of the as yet not quite open, but soon will be Neon Museum in Las Vegas. And some of the signs from that collection are on view at the Nevada State Museum in an exhibit called Neon Unplugged Signs from the Boneyard. Also, more on our website at theconnection.org if you want to look at what's there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from...
With the lightning is the glow from the neon sign.